everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your new Comics Wednesday episode for September 23rd, 2020. And I'm going to be flying solo on this one, but that's okay because I'm going to go really quickly because we have a ton of books to talk about. There are so many good books out this week. I kind of feel like September has been a little bit of a slow month. And now all of a sudden, here we are, the next to last week of the month, on the 23rd, and we just have a ton of great books, especially a big week for Marvel. I feel like I'm talking about like 10 Marvel books. I'm not really sure, but we have some independent stuff to talk about. We have some Image stuff to talk about, and there's still more books I could have talked about, but I set the limit at lucky number 13. So I'm going to try to fly through these as quickly as possible. And the first book I want to talk about is an indie book, as I mentioned. It's from Aftershock Comics. It's called Miles to Go. It's issue number one. It's from writer B. Clay Moore. We have art and colors by Stephen Molnar and letters by Thomas Maurer. And the reason I wanted to talk about this is it's really, really good. For those not familiar with B. Clay Moore's work, he kind of works in that crime noir, kind of the more realistic corner of the comics universe, if you will. Hawaiian Dick is what a lot of people know him for or battle him. And here he's doing a Miles to Go for Aftershock. And it's about a single mother. She's newly divorced and she has a young daughter and her past is sort of catching up to her. She was an assassin, I guess is the way you would put it. And, but it was when she was a kid. She had a mentor and now that mentor's on his deathbed. And for whatever reason, there are shadowy figures that are now pursuing this woman, Amara, and we're just not sure why exactly that's happening or why exactly Amara's past is catching up with her. But she's a very down-to-earth, very grounded character. We see that in the first issue that's expertly written as an introductory to the character by B. Clay Moore, a great art by Stephen Molnar as well. The art is really grounded and the color work as well. It's you know, it's pretty muted colors, very realistic art. And that all really sets up a great first issue that gives you just enough introduction to kind of hook you without being, you know, really heavy on the exposition. And we certainly have a lot of questions still to be answered, but it's not all crammed at us. The issue definitely has room to breathe. It's paced well. And I read it because, first of all, Aftershock, so high quality. Second of all, B. Clay Moore, I'm a fan of his work. So I was kind of expecting it to be pretty good, but it really exceeded my expectations. It was excellent. It's one of those books that as soon as I finished reading it, I wanted the next issue. So it ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. I can't wait to see where we go with the next issue, but I was really, really impressed. Highly recommend picking it up. And again, it's one of those stories that I think is going to read really well altogether, but at the same time, you know, you pick it up episodically in the floppies and it reminds you of the power of comics, right? Of getting that serialized story and, you know, hooks you and leaves you wanting more. So I really felt like it was a good chunk of story, very well done. And I think not enough people hear about these Aftershock comics, even though they're great, great stories. And so I wanted to be sure to talk about it and let everybody know. So Miles to Go, number one, Aftershock Comics, B. Clay Moore, Stephen Molinari, definitely worth your time. Next book I'm going to talk about, also an independent book from IDW. It's the second issue of Canto, number two, The Hollow Men. It's from writer David Ambur and artist Drew Zucker, with colors by Vittorio Estoni and letters by And World Designs. Again, for those not familiar with Canto, he's a little clockwork knight. The first volume of Canto was very well received. I've talked about it being a real adventure story. You know, it's kind of fantasy, if you will, and these clockwork knights are cursed and they're enslaved. And in the first volume, Canto frees them. And in the first issue of the second volume, we find out that although Canto is a hero to his people and believes that he had saved the clockwork knights, his fellow clockwork knights, and Clockwork Citizens from this evil wizard. It turns out that he hasn't. There's still a curse on them, and if they don't return to enslavement and continue to toil away for this wizard, their clockwork hearts are going to run down. They're going to die, all except for Kanto himself, who has managed to break the curse, but he certainly doesn't want to be the last of his race. So he goes on a quest to try to figure out how to vanquish the Shrouded Man, this evil wizard, once and for all. But this time he's not alone. Three of his fellow clockwork knights, who have been inspired by the heroism that Kanto has showed in the past, are joining him on the quest. So we saw that all unfold in the first issue of Volume 2. And now in the second issue, we see that that story is starting to unfold. And the other cool thing that David Boer and Drew Zucker are doing in Volume 2 is they're returning to places and returning to characters that we saw in that first volume. So there's definitely some continuity there. There's some familiarity with characters, and the stakes are being raised for Kanto as he realized there are other injustices in the world. And again, it's his heart, his figurative heart, I guess you would say, not his clockwork heart, his courage, you know, his spirit that is inspiring. And even though he's under no obligation to help these others who are suffering, that's just who he is at the core of his being. So I've said before in discussing Kanto what a great bedtime story is for younger readers. If you're trying to get your early teens or you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old to read, this is a great way to do it. You know, you've got really great art by Drew Zucker, along with the words. You know, those illustrations really pull kids into the story. There's great color work by Stoney. So I really, really recommend this for younger readers, for kids who are trying to get into reading, or if you're trying to encourage them to read. By all means, go and buy the first volume of Kanto in trade paperback. And if you want to wait for the second volume to come out in trade paperback, you know, you can do that as well. But the other thing that's fun is, you know, get your kids into the habit of going to the comic shop once a month, if you will, when Kanto comes out. And who knows what else might catch their eye. And then, you know, you've made a lifelong reader. I mean, that's part of the reason that I love to read when I was a kid is it was comics. Comics were like a gateway thing for me. And, you know, of course, I read voraciously, not just comics, but also prose and novels and, you know, all kinds of other stuff as well. So I really do think it's a great book for kids, for all ages. There's a lot there, and some of it might go over their head, some of the relationship type stuff and the kind of the themes, but that's what makes it great for all ages. It's what makes it so that I enjoy it, because these are universal themes that, you know, we all can relate to. Friendship and relationships and obligation to family and duty and, you know, all that stuff is worthwhile, but it's also really great for younger readers too, to kind of expose them to those sorts of ideas. And it can help later on when you talk about English class and, you know, critical thinking and all that kind of stuff, reading comprehension and all those things that come along later in high school and college. So really, really am enjoying Kanto too. I think actually 2 issues in to Volume 2, I think I like Volume 2 even more than Volume 1. I think it's even better. I mean, Volume 1 as a whole is great, but if I compare the first 2 issues with Volume 1 to the first 2 issues of Volume 2, this feels a little more complete, which maybe that's not 100% a fair comparison, because obviously Volume 2 here gets to build on things that were built out in Volume 1, where in that volume, Boer was still, you know, building the world and still introducing us to ideas and concepts. And so it's not 100% fair comparison, but this is a really great book. And it's another one of those independents that I think not enough people are reading. It definitely has more buzz on it. And the first volume was received really well. And some of those first single issues are pretty hard to find, actually. So I'm glad that people are reading it, but I think even more people should be reading it, because it really does deserve to be read by everybody. It's that good. All right, next up I have an Image title. It's another independent here. It's Undiscovered Country, issue number 8, written by Scott Snyder and Charles Soule. We have art by Giuseppe Camincola and Leonardo Marcello Grassi. Colors are by Matt Wilson and letters are by Crank. First, a little bit about the art. I love Camo's art. It's been really great in the series so far. I don't know if, I know he's busy. This isn't the only thing that he's doing. And so I don't know if he just fell behind and he needed help from Grassi to kind of catch up. It's not really clear to me who is doing what, if they're splitting things up page by page, but I think maybe that's the case. The art just feels a little inconsistent to me. The art on the series has been pretty good so far, but this isn't quite up to the standards that it has been before. And that's not to say the art's bad. It's still above average, but the art that Camo was doing on his own in the early issues just really blew me away. And so it's probably just a matter of him falling a little bit behind and needing help, which is fine. It's still, you know, nice to look at, but it's not, you know, to that exemplary level that it was before. As far as the story, it's a little bit of a down issue in terms of the action that we've had almost nonstop in the series so far. The group that went into the United States that had been sealed off from the rest of the world, you know, we saw them go through the first of the 13 colonies or zones, if you will, so far and in the series, and now we're seeing them take their step into the second colony or zone, which is called Unity. It's vastly different from the kind of Mad Max wasteland of the first zone. It's much more technological. It's much more advanced, and we're starting to get a little bit more backstory and understand not necessarily why the United States closed themselves off, but the consequences of that. You know, there's an after the sealing timeline in the back matter of the book that talks about what happened on day zero, the first week, the second week, and so on and so forth. It gives a little bit of insight. And we also, I expect, we'll learn more about exactly what happened in terms of scientific advancement, because that's what this zone is all about. It's all about technology. They have really advanced technology that they can control somewhat through the power of their mind. And obviously that's, you know, far in advance of anything that this group of explorers have ever seen before. So as I said, a little bit of a down issue, but that's perfectly fine. I feel like Snyder and Soul are just setting us up for what's going to come next in this Unity zone, because we are learning a lot, and there's a lot of questions being raised in this issue. So that's why I say it feels much like a setup issue. And I don't particularly think that we're going to get all the answers in this Unity zone, but we are going to start to discover more things that I think are going to give the story more weight. And what I'm waiting for is a little more exploration of the relationship between the different characters. A lot of times what I found so far is it's a lot about how the explorers, the characters, are relating to their situation and the landscape, you know, the zones and the people in the zones, more so than how they're relating to each other. And I think there's still a lot to be mined in how they relate to each other, especially when you talk about the siblings of Daniel and Charlotte. And that may come as we learn more about what their parents' involvement was in the sealing and why they stayed behind, why their parents chose to send Daniel and Charlotte away. If what they were doing was to keep the United States safe, you would think they would want to keep their children safe as well. So I expect that to be explored. But that's my number one question, the number one thing I want to know. I want to see more of their relationship, see more of how they interact, more of what their feelings are for each other, because I feel like there's so much territory to mine there, and we haven't even scratched the surface on it yet. And really, that's the case with a lot of the characters and their interactions in the story. As far as the explorers go, there's a lot we don't know, and they're interesting characters, and their motivations for why they are the way they are, why they chose to pursue the things that they're interested in, why are they experts in what they're experts in, and why do they choose to go on this mission, which could have been a one-way trip for all they knew, and very well could be from what we're seeing so far. So Undiscovered Country, if you haven't been reading it, it's been selling gangbusters. It's a really great story. And one last thing I'll mention about it is how interesting and prescient it has been for Snyder and Soul, you know, here we are telling a story, or they are telling a story about a United States that's cut off from the rest of the world. And clearly we're not to that point with this pandemic we're in, but we certainly are much, much more sealed off from the rest of the world, much more isolated than we were when they first conceived of this story, or throughout the, you know, development of it and the release of the first few issues. Now, all of a sudden, some of these ideas and themes they're exploring are vastly more topical than they ever possibly could have imagined. So it makes for a really interesting reading in our current societal and political climate. So, all right, up next, I'm going to talk about Joshua Williamson's final issue of The Flash. It's issue 762. He's credited as the storyteller, along with Howard Porter, who does the artwork. We have Hi-Fi on colors and Steve Wands on letters. So this is Finish Line, and Joshua Williamson has a little note in the back of the book saying, "Thank you to all the readers and everyone who worked on this Flash run with me. Thank you for the greatest race of my life, Joshua." So I feel like this really puts a kind of a stamp or a period on the end of the sentence when it comes to Josh's run here. I don't think it's going to go down as beloved as like the Mark Waid run or the Geoff Johns run, but Williamson has really been telling one story here. And I think maybe that's where some people kind of fall down with it. They don't enjoy it as much as those other two classic runs that I mentioned, because really this has been the Flash and the Reverse Flash's story. That's what the whole thing has been about. And Williamson does a great job in this final story arc of showing us that, of tying everything together, and not only tying the Flash story together, but also tying up a lot of other things that have happened in the DC universe in the past couple of years. And, you know, the argument can be made, it's been kind of messy and there's been things that haven't worked. Heroes in Crisis with the whole Sanctuary thing and Wally West, and that wasn't that well received. And some other things with Snyder's run, Justice League, and all that. And The Flash really, you know, when we talked about Rebirth coming down the line and what Geoff Johns was trying to do, Flash was one of those books that I can't remember if Joshua Williamson said it or who exactly said it, but I remember saying it on the podcast, along with Teen Titans, where Wally West was that Flash was going to be the book you needed to pay attention to find out the ramifications of Rebirth, right? It didn't all play out like maybe we thought it would have, because of the changes with Rebirth, because of editorial, because of shifting timelines and all that kind of thing. And Rebirth kind of lost momentum and sales fell off and all that. And I totally get that, and it happens. And DC didn't do a great job. You know, they often get these really great initiatives and have high sales numbers, but they just don't seem to know how to finish sometimes. All that being said, Joshua Williamson has been on Flash since the beginning of Rebirth, all the way through to this 762. And that whole story, as I said, it's pretty much Barry Allen and Reverse Flash. It's their story. And read it all at once in one sitting, read it all, you know, obviously it's a lot to read in one sitting, but read it all together as one narrative. I think it accomplishes what Josh set out to do, which is really define who Barry is, who he has been, what his role is in the DC universe, and then leave him in a place where he's going to grow as a character. You know, he's a classic character when you think about it. You know, Showcase 4, which launched the Silver Age of comics, you know, landmark issue, a new version of the Flash. It wasn't Jay Garrick. It wasn't the Golden Age Flash anymore. It was Barry Allen, different costume, same powers, but different costume, different person, and really, you know, launched the Silver Age. And Barry has pretty much been the same guy. He's had the same sort of things that he has struggled with throughout his, you know, classic run that ended when Crisis on Infinite Earth started. And then even when Geoff Johns brought him back, there's always been that thing he hasn't been able to let go of, things in his past, regret, and all that sort of stuff. And what's great about what Joshua Williamson has done is he set it up so that Barry can finally leave that in the past. And he does it in such a way that is realistic and meaningful and it makes sense. You know, you can read the story, you can see what happens, you can see the interaction between Barry and Reverse Flash. You can see why Barry will finally make the choices that he makes and try to leave some of that regret behind. And so I don't know who's taking over the Flash, but they really, it's like a wide open road. You know, I was going to say a clean slate, but for Flash running down the road, let's say a wide open road. So I think Williamson did a really great job. I can understand why some people felt like maybe it was slow or it wasn't paced really well, because again, Williamson was sort of telling one long epic story. And so I can see how some people would feel like, oh, I'm just not getting enough out of it. It wasn't rich enough for them. I understand that, but I also, you know, credit Josh for, you know, having this idea, sticking to it and really diving deep and exploring everything about Reverse Flash and Barry and that relationship, and culminating it with this final story, this finish line story, to have it all make sense. As far as the artwork goes, I mean, it's Howard Porter. Howard Porter was born to draw the Flash. I think he draws Flash just about as good or better than anybody. That being said, I did feel like the pages toward the end of the book, where it's a lot of the Flash family not in their costumes and just in their civilian identities, I felt like the anatomy was a little wonky on some of those. Like some of the heads looked a little too big, but I'm just nitpicking. Overall, great issue. The color work by Hi-Fi is also done really, really well. And all in all, I'm happy to see this this arc, this run, this epic run by Joshua Williamson come to a conclusion. And I'm glad Josh got to tell the story he wanted to tell. And I'm very excited to see who takes over the Flash coming up next. So, all right, let me move on to the next book I'm going to talk about. Let's start diving into some of the Marvel titles. We have a one-shot by writer Al Ewing. Art is by John Davis Hunt. Colors are by Marcio Menez, with letters by Corey Petit. And it's Immortal She-Hulk number one. So, The Immortal Hulk by Al Ewing and Joe Bennett has been a monster hit, a runaway hit. Al Ewing is really going back to the roots of The Incredible Hulk, back to the very first issue, and that question inside the question mark on the cover, man or monster, right? We even talked to Al about that at New York Comic Con a few years ago, and it feels like this is a way to pull She-Hulk into that same world. I don't know that it was necessary to really pull She-Hulk from the more traditional heroic side of the Marvel Universe, where Hulk has really lived in the past, you know, before Al did his groundbreaking work here on the Immortal Hulk. But I guess the powers that be, or maybe Al Ewing himself, has decided that, well, if She-Hulk got her powers from a blood transfusion from her cousin, it would make sense that a lot of what he's going through would affect her as well. A lot of the things that we learned about him are true of her as well. Is she immortal? Can she die? I mean, she's died, you know, twice recently. I mean, you can talk about her dying the first time when she was shot, when she had to get the blood transfusion. And then, you know, we talk about her being killed in Civil War II. And then most recently in the Empire story that just ended from Marvel. And I mean, that it's the Immortal She-Hulk, but the subtitle is The Three Deaths of Jennifer Walters. So those deaths are all explored here. And Jennifer, she's trying to understand herself. And again, if you are reading Immortal Hulk, this is a must read for you. It's just like another issue of Immortal Hulk, because I gotta think that She-Hulk's going to be showing up in Immortal Hulk soon, based on what we see here. And not only that, there are things that happen in this issue that She-Hulk learns and then forgets that are relevant to things that we're going to see coming up in Immortal Hulk. So this is a must read if you're reading Immortal Hulk. As far as the art goes, man, John Davis Hunt, love his art. Absolutely love his art. Ever since I saw him on the Gail Simone series Clean Room, I've loved his art. And he did the Wildstorm series with Warren Ellis. And now here, like his art is similar to Joe Bennett in the level of detail and how clean the lines are. So I love that they got an artist who, you know, if you were to throw this Immortal She-Hulk issue into an Immortal Hulk trade paperback, the artwork wouldn't look out of place. It's not real incongruous. It's not going to shock you and pull you out of the story and go, wait, why does this look so much different? I mean, it clearly is not Joe Bennett art, but the style is the same, and it's gorgeous artwork. So as far as the story itself, like I said, it's good. It ties in. It's in the same vein of Immortal Hulk. And that's a great series. And I don't mean to nitpick at all, but I have to say, I'm such a Hulk fan, and I love, my favorite Hulk's like the Professor Hulk, right? Like after 377, when Peter David merged them all together, and he was smart, and it's like the most super heroic version of Hulk. And we're getting far away from that. We're definitely in the horror side of things, which is fine. It's interesting. It's really great stories, and I'm enjoying it. But I do miss the superhero Hulk. I have to admit, I do miss that aspect of it. And now we're getting the same thing with She-Hulk, but I don't mind it as much with her, because I feel like ever since they did they changed She-Hulk after Civil War II, where she's not, you know, now she has trouble talking and she's much more like the old Savage Hulk. I haven't enjoyed the character as much. I think it's boring. I think they took away what was the coolest thing about She-Hulk was the fact that she maintained her personality and she was even more confident. And, you know, I just liked, you know, the classic Jen Walters She-Hulk, you know, from John Byrne, cracking jokes, being a lawyer, all that kind of thing. And this, the one that's been in the Avengers, where she's looks much more like a guy and she's, you know, super ripped and, you know, talks in broken sentences. It just hasn't been interesting to me. So I don't know if bringing her into the horror side of things and having her title and her character dovetail more closely with what's been going on in Immortal Hulk will change that and get her back to the old She-Hulk. I wouldn't mind that, but I also don't mind if, you know, we just continue on this Immortal Hulk path for a while. I mean, it's been so successful. I can't see them changing it anytime soon. Although I do hope someday we do get back to the superheroic versions of Hulk and She-Hulk. So definitely worth picking up. Like I said, great artwork. Paul Mounce does the colors. He's the same color artist that does the Immortal Hulk issue. So it definitely, again, just like with John Davis Hunt's pencils, it's not going to look out of place if you package it up in a trade paperback with issues of Immortal Hulk. So if you read Immortal Hulk, definitely pick this up. You need to read this. Really, really good. And I did enjoy seeing Jen not as the Hulk, talking in complete senses. We'll get some of that as well. All right, up next, another Marvel title. It's Juggernaut number one. This is the first in, I think it's going to be a 5-issue limited series. It's written by Fabian Nicieza. We have art by Ron Garney, colors by Matt Milla, and letters by Joe Sabino. It was okay. It wasn't great. It wasn't terrible. I'm going to reserve judgment to see where this goes. I do like the Juggernaut. I'm a fan. He gets a new costume here. I don't know if Garney designed it, but it looks really, really awesome. And this series is supposed to explore who the Juggernaut is. He's not a mutant, but he's always lived in the X-Men corner of the Marvel Universe, that mutant corner. And now, you know, we know the mutants are over on Krakoa with what Jonathan Hickman and all the people, all the creative people that have been working on the X-Men corner. So what happens to Juggernaut? Because he can't go there. He's not a mutant. So that's really what the series is exploring. In recent years, they've got away from him being so much a villain. He certainly isn't a hero. He says as much himself. You know, he says, I'm more of a supervillain than a superhero. But he's also not 100%, you know, bad guy like he used to be. He's not the mustache twirling villain that he used to be, or just the muscle for Black Tom Cassidy that he used to be. He's willing to do some good, kind of looking out for himself, but we see that here. He's working for Damage Incorporated, doing certain things, and it's interesting. So I don't know where we go from here. I'm not sure what exactly is going to happen, but it is a good start to the story, but not a great start. I just feel like we didn't quite get enough. Nicieza didn't give us enough in the first story to really have an idea of what direction this is going to go. It feels like a lot of setup, which is okay. You know, it's a first issue. We get introduced to some new characters, and we get a tease of what might be coming up in the next issue that has me really excited. Looks like we might get a lot of action, and the Juggernaut may take on one of the classic foes, one of his classic arch nemesis that he always fights, and it ends up being a, you know, really cool fight. So hoping that we get that next issue, because this issue is also a little short on the action. I think the best thing about it was just, this is the most I've ever seen any sort of attempt at character development from anybody to do with the Juggernaut. We haven't gotten there yet. We haven't kind of gotten inside him and kind of understand what makes him tick. But the seeds are there. And so if you're a fan of the Juggernaut, I think you'll probably like this. For some reason, I thought it was a one-shot. And then I read it and I'm like, well, clearly it's not a one-shot. Clearly it's to be continued. And I do like that he's getting his own series for four or five issues, and we're going to get to explore him a little more. So, and again, the new costume looks great, especially the way it's colored by Matt Miller. And for those that read Charles Soule's Daredevil run, that was Ron Garney handling art and Matt Miller on colors. And so it's very reminiscent of that, which I don't know if it's the best look for Juggernaut, but it's not quite as dark. It's not quite as crime noir. So the art is, it's still Ron Garney art, but it's a little cleaner. It's a little brighter. I guess you'd say things are a little easier to see. There's not as much shadow. So I think the art does a good job. I think the second issue is really going to be telling for this series based on who we're teased that is going to show up in the second issue, and what the art is going to look like in the second issue, based on who it is. That could really make or break this series for me. It could really tell me, okay, am I going to keep reading it, or am I going to just give it a pass? Issue two will definitely tell me. And I will also say that the regular cover for this issue by Jeff Shaw and Matt Miller is also really, really awesome looking. So, all right, up next, I'm going to talk about another Marvel book, and we're going to go back to the Hulk family with Maestro number 2. So this is from writer Peter David. Art is by Herman Peralta. Colors are by Jesus Arbatov. Letters are by Ariana Marr. And then there's a backup story called Relics, where the art is by Dale Keown and the colors are by Jason Keith. So the first issue of Maestro really blew me away. I think it was my book of the week. It was awesome. And it really set up putting Bruce Banner, putting the Hulk on the path of becoming the Maestro. And I talked about how we're probably going to see him make decisions he doesn't necessarily want to make. And we're going to, you know, be rooting against him making those decisions. But understanding why he does make them. That's not what happens in this issue. It felt so different from issue one. It's much more practical. I feel like this issue has a lot less of the sort of big ideas that the first issue introduced that we were going to explore. This issue is a lot of, okay, now that the Hulk's been out in the real world now for a little while, he sees that the human race has basically brought itself to the brink of extinction, and he doesn't think that they're worth saving. And now he's just being practical about it. He's just going around trying to learn more about the world. So it feels a little disconnected to me from the first issue. I don't know how it would read, you know, if I read them back to back. But again, it may be that this is just a little bit of a transition issue till we get to issue 3 and we start getting back on that theme of okay, the Hulk's got to make some decisions, and they're not necessarily good decisions, but he's sort of forced into it. So it wasn't a bad issue. It just didn't blow me away like the first one did. The first one just completely blew my mind. It was absolutely amazing. Still enjoyable. It's still very reminiscent of that classic Hulk era of Peter David in the late 80s through the 90s, which is, you know, my favorite era of the Hulk and, you know, right in my wheelhouse, a lot of nostalgia. I mentioned last week that I thought the Herman Peralta art does an incredible job of kind of being in that same vein of that Dale Keown art from the time. And then, of course, we have Dale Keown doing the part one of this backup story called Relics, which, I mean, the regular story was good. Like I said, the main story was good, even though it didn't blow me away like issue one did. But the backup story, I'm not going to say anything about it because I don't want to give away anything. I want you to read it for yourself. But the backup story is awesome. It is so good. It's only a couple of pages. Let's see. It lasts for 1, 2, 3 pages. And it's fantastic. It's so, so good. And the fact that I know we're going to get more because it says Relics Part 1 of 3 is fantastic. So I definitely think Maestro is worth picking up, especially if you're a fan of Peter David Hulk. And again, I just think, you know, it's the nature of comics. It's the nature of the way the narrative goes with this kind of storytelling, where you're going to have issues that are up and down. And I feel like this was more of a connective issue where we didn't explore a lot of themes, but we needed to get some setup. We needed to move Hulk around. We needed to see him discover things about the world. And we needed to see things about the world as well to understand where the Hulk is coming from and how he gets to where he's eventually going to end up as the Maestro. So still really great story, absolutely beautiful art, but not quite as good as the first issue. So, all right, another Marvel book. This is one a lot of people are going to be wondering about. It's Ten of Swords or X of Swords, however you want to pronounce it. But it is Ten of Swords because it comes from the tarot cards. And, you know, the ten of in a tarot deck is an X. It's called the Ten of Swords. So written by Jonathan Hickman and Tinney Howard. We have art by Pepe Larraz, colors by Marte Garcia. Letters are by Clayton Cowles. Design is by Tom Muller. Jonathan Hickman likes to throw these weird pages in his comics these days. He started doing it, well, the first time I saw him doing it, he may have done it sooner. First time I remember seeing him doing it is East of West. He may have done it before that. I'm trying to think of some other earlier titles. I'm drawing a blank. But he's done it in other books since then. And he does it here where he throws in just, and you've probably seen it in some of the Dawn of X or House of X or Powers of X books. So he does it as a way to dump information, as a way to give us exposition, as a way to break up the story. And so, I mean, it works okay. I'm not the biggest fan of it. The other thing I'll say about this book is it's 68 pages or so. So it's a really big book. And if you've been reading House of X and Dawn of X, you're going to have a much easier time kind of understanding. And I'm behind on that stuff. I mean, I have the general idea of what's going on with Krakoa and the council and that kind of thing. But if you're caught up, you're probably going to have a little bit easier time than I did. That's not to say I had a terrible time. And that's not to say if you haven't been reading those books at all, that you can't just pick this up and read it and enjoy it, because it gives you everything you need to know, with the caveat that it's Jonathan Hickman and it is weird. So even if you have read everything, all the X-Men stuff Jonathan Hickman has been doing, it's still going to feel a little weird. Some of the ideas, the things that are thrown at you and the terminology and even the artwork and the way things look, it's still going to be, you're not going to be 100% there. You're still going to be kind of like, wait, what? That's weird. Even if you read anything. So if you haven't read anything, you're going to get that. Hey, that's weird. What? You're going to have that, but don't feel like you're getting that because you haven't read everything, every, you know, X-Men book in Hickman's X universe. you're still going to be lost. He's still introducing new ideas, and I shouldn't say you're going to be lost, but you're still going to get that, well, that's a weird kind of thing that he's doing. He just, it's the way he tells his stories now. He likes to be out there, you know. He likes to do alternate dimension stuff and alternate universe stuff and dimensional gateway travel and all that sort of thing. So I don't know if he thinks it makes it interesting or doesn't make it interesting. I thought this was an okay issue. The thing that I like most about what is being set up here is the thing that doesn't have anything to do with all that weirdness. It's just the plain old, okay, you're going to get 10 people and you're going to get 10 people and they're going to go get 10. They're each going to go get a sword, you know? So you're really telling them a story of a MacGuffin hunt, right? Like you pick 10 champions and you, and the bad guys are going to pick 10 champions and they each have to go find 10 swords, 10 specific swords. And then they're going to come together and fight, right? Like that story's been told a bunch of times, right? Like, here's your champions. Your champions have to go find X and your champions have to go find Y. And then they're going to come together and fight. Like whenever I think about a MacGuffin hunt, I always think back to the first serialized G.I. Joe 5-part cartoon where G.I. Joe and Cobra were racing for, I think they had to go find like some special hard water and some special like crystals. I can't remember what the other thing was, rocks or something. I don't remember, but that's exactly what this is. So, you know, you can dress it, Jonathan Hickman can dress it up however he wants. At the end of the day, it's X-Men going and finding swords and these villains who are really interesting take on the villains. I could see them sticking around for a long time. So if you're one of those people that likes to pick up, you know, first appearances for characters that may be important later on, you might want to pick this up if you normally weren't planning on it. But other than that, I think it's going to be okay. I think it's going to be an X-Men event. You know, it's going to be Extinction Agenda or, you know, the Phalanx Covenant or whatever. It's just going to be another X-Men event. I don't think it's going to be groundbreaking. If there's anything long lasting that comes out of it, maybe some of these swords continue to show up in the Marvel Universe. Maybe some of these villains that we're seeing show up, hang around and come back and become X-Men villains. As far as the art goes, it's Pepe Larraz art. So, you know, it's good, but it's not as good as I've seen his art before. You know, his art on Extermination. That's what I'm trying to think of. That was like next level art for me. And he's done a really great art on some other things as well here. And I think it has a lot to do with how dark, his artwork is colored. And I'm sure that's by design by Marte Garcia. Because again, it is a dark story and we're in these other dimensions where things are dark. And so for that reason, I feel like it doesn't give Pepe's art, it doesn't do it justice. It's a little muddy for my taste. And I know his art normally isn't like that. So it's still beautiful to look at. But again, with those weird text pages that Hickman throws in there, it also disrupts the art flow for me a little bit. I'm not a big fan of that. But again, $6.99, you're getting 68 pages or 60 pages or whatever it is without ads and interior cover work. So it's a big chunk of story. And I thought it was okay. I'm, you know, I ordered a copy, of course, because it had a Mark Brooks wraparound cover, and based on these other new characters that are showing up here, I may, when I get to the comic shop tomorrow, pick up a second copy, whatever other cover catches my eye, just in case, cover myself, in case another one of these characters ends up being really important down the line. So, all right, another Marvel book I already had a chance to read. I talked about the first issue when it came out. It's Fantastic Four Antithesis from storytellers Mark Waid and Neil Adams. Neil Adams handles the pencil work as well. Inks by Mark Farmer, colors are by Laura Martin, and letters are by Joe Caramagna. So I didn't want to spoil it last time that the meteor that was crashing to Earth in the first issue wasn't really a meteor at all, but it was, in fact, Silver Surfer. So he shows up, Fantastic Four kind of nurse him back to health, and we find out that this evil, monstrous villain has come from the negative zone called, he's calling him like the Anti-Galactus or the Antithesis of Galactus. So that's where we get the title of the series. And he's kind of put Galactus out of commission, and he's recruiting an army, and they're going to come and he's going to continue to take over this universe as opposed to the negative zone where he came from. And so the Fantastic Four have to stop him. A little bit better in terms of narrative and plot flow and dialogue this time than the last issue. Last issue was really kind of poor in that regard. It's classic Neil Adams art. I feel like the art's a little better as well. I mean, Neil Adams is Neil Adams. It's classic stuff, but not to nitpick, but he doesn't have, he's not to the same level he was when he was at his peak. But it's still good art, good storytelling, from panel to panel and transitions and what have you. I do feel like it's an improvement over the first issue. The color work is done really well, but there's nothing special here. As I said, I think that the first issue was below average, I would say. And I think this brings it up to average, but it's still not anything like you need to go out and read this. It's mind blowing. It's groundbreaking. It's like the best thing Mark Waid has ever done or the best thing Neil Adams has ever done. No, it's not that. If you're a big Fantastic Four fan, I still think you could even skip it and you wouldn't be missing much. But if you're a giant Neil Adams fan and you love Silver Surfer and you love Galactus and you love the Fantastic Four, then I'd say, yeah, probably pick it up, maybe wait for the trade, because it's just okay. It's not anything that's super great. We do get a cool looking preview for the next issue, which looks like they might be doing something different that might be worth a look. But we haven't gotten to that point where I think that this is like you can't miss this. Because again, honestly, the best thing about this comic is the color work by Laura Martin. That's the only thing here that I feel like is above average. So, if you're a Neil Adams fan or a huge Fantastic Four fan, pick it up, thumb through it. Probably get a pretty good idea just by thumbing through it if you'll want to pick it up or not. So not much more to say about Fantastic Four Antithesis. All right. I got a couple more Marvel books here. Next one I'll talk about is Daredevil Truth or Dare Part 2. It's issue 22 from writer Chip Zdarsky. We have pencils by Francesco Mobili, inks by Victor Olazaba, and colors by Mattia Iacono. Really like what Zdarsky's been doing. I'm not the biggest Zdarsky fan in the world, but he does seem to have a really good take on who Daredevil is. So I'm really enjoying what he's doing and some of the ideas that he's sparking in the book. Daredevil's been around a long time, and to keep putting Matt through the paces but do it in new and different ways is really cool. There's a couple of little Easter eggs that are planted here with the possibility of Daredevil maybe getting a new costume, and that's kind of teased on the front cover. There's also a great scene with Daredevil interacting with another Marvel hero, kind of calling him out a little bit in a way that's sort of topical for the political climate of today. And then we get somebody showing up on the last page who's a surprise kind of guest star who's going to be coming into the book over the next few issues, I imagine. That's really great to see. That's also going to kind of play with Matt's emotions, and it's going to be great to see him interact with that character and after everything that's happened over the past 20 issues or so, or even more, really when you talk about what happened in the Charles Soule run and in the Zdarsky run so far. So Daredevil's been fantastic. For me, it's the best thing I've ever read that Zdarsky's done. There's things that I've read by him that I absolutely can't stand, and there's things that I've read by him that I feel are technically good, but I don't necessarily agree with sort of philosophically I have problems with. But this, his Daredevil run, it fires on all cylinders for me. He's a wonderful Daredevil writer. And I love the Charles Soule run. And, if you listen to this podcast, Charles is a friend, and I hated to see him leave Daredevil. And if you asked me, well, can you keep Charles on the book, or would you take Zdarsky? I would actually have a hard time answering that question. And I never thought I would get to that point. I just thought that'd be a no-brainer. Now I want Charles to be able to finish. But this is that good. So, you know, I did want to see what other ideas Charles had, but this is great too. So I guess I want both. I guess I want two Daredevil books, which Daredevil is not even one of my favorite characters, but this is a compelling read. Then that, you know, that's how good Soul's run was. That's how good Zdarsky's run is. And as far as the art goes, I'm not familiar with Francesco Mobili, but beautiful art, clean lines, really great action scenes. The color work, it's not that dark and gritty, really shadowy stuff that Matt Miller did on the book, like I was talking about earlier when I was talking about Juggernaut and Matt Miller. But Matteo Iacono does a great job of keeping the palette subdued and keeping it feeling like it's that crime noir story. And so I really, you know, appreciate that very, very consistent look. And yeah, not familiar with Mobili's work on lines, but fascinating the way he lays things out, like really great. I don't want to use the word cinematic, but he's a great storyteller, and his layouts within the panels are very, I don't want to use that word cinematic because that evokes like this widescreen feel, but there's something very much that reminds me of television, of the visual live action medium of that motion. And I think it has a lot to do with the camera angles. Because you could easily see this issue of Daredevil, or I could easily picture this issue of Daredevil as an episode of the Daredevil Netflix TV show, where we're seeing these exact same scenes in the panels play out, you know, on a small screen on the TV. So again, I think I'm not sure what it is about his art. Maybe it is that layout within the panels, or the way he does transitions from panel to panel. But man, I'm blown away by how good this artwork is. Like, I would probably pick up a book that he drew even if I wasn't reading it, just based on the strength of his art. Like, I think it's that good. He's definitely one to watch. So again, not sure if I've read anything he's done before, but he really got my attention to the point where, you know, I'll be looking him up later, learn more about him, see what other work he's done so I can take a look, because it's really, really good. All right. I think there's two more Marvel books to talk about. I told you there was a lot of Marvel guys. Next up is Doctor Doom, number 7. This is from writer Christopher Cantwell. Another great artist on this one, Salvador LaRocca, handling the line work. Color art is by Guru EFX, and letters are by Corey Petit. Yeah, Salvador LaRocca, that guy is one of the best artists working in comics today, just without question. And Christopher Cantwell, I've talked before about what a fan I am of him, and how he loves to really dive deep into character. He just had Iron Man, first issue of Iron Man, come out last week. More of a fun title, a little bit of humor in it, but still establishing kind of a new direction for Tony. This Doom series he's been doing is all about character. It's all about exploring who Doom is. And he's really getting into that place where Doom isn't a hero. Doom isn't a villain. Doom is Doom. And he's unique in that way. He's complicated and he's complex and he lives in the gray area. And yes, he has his flaws and his foibles, but he always does what he does for a reason, and he always does it because he's being true to who he is. And Cantwell is exploring who that is and the way Doom sees himself and the way he reflects on himself. And in that way, how he sees himself affects how his relationships are with the people around him, which most of the time that relationship is he's the master and they're the servant, but there's much more to that. And that's putting, you know, that's making it too easy. That's simplifying things too much to just say Doom's the ruler and they're the subjects, and it's making Doom a two-dimensional character. And that's, you know, getting into the danger of having Doom be this mustache twirling tyrant. And that's not who Doom is. There's so much more to that. You know, when I last talked to Christopher Campbell, I had him on the show, you know, he talked about how much Doom loves his people, his subjects in Latveria. He talked about how not enough people explore the magic side of Doom with the sorcery and, you know, the fact that he's not just a scientist, he's not just into technology. So all that is being explored here. It's a political book, but it's also a very emotional book and a very psychological book and a very cerebral book. And it's all laid out beautifully with incredible color work by Guru FX and great line work by Salvador LaRocca. I mean, Christopher Cantwell has to be just over the moon. The fact that he's got Cafu doing Iron Man with him and Christopher LaRocca, you know, one of the probably top three or four comic artists working today on this Dr. Doom book. And usually you think, okay, we're going to do a Dr. Doom book. You know, it's a second tier book. You're not going to put this, you know, A-list artist on there, but man, 100% put Salvador LaRocca on there. I mean, he did a great job with Darth Vader, similar to Doom in a lot of ways. And now having him on this book is spectacular. So this was just a great issue. I mean, Doom comes riding in at one point on a bear. You know, I hate to spoil, but like that's worth the price of admission right there. Seeing Doom riding a bear. It's just, and beautifully illustrated by Salvador LaRocca. Like I want that. I would put that up on my wall. Like if I had the original art, of course, Salvador LaRocca original art, I'd put it up on my wall. But if I had a print of that, I would put that print up on my wall of Doom riding the bear. It's awesome. Doom riding a freaking bear. So, so good. So really curious to see where this goes next. Christopher Cantwell, this guy's going to be a superstar comic artist. Mark my words, this guy's going to be up there. He's going to be in demand. People are going to be clamoring. And, you know, he still does work on the television side of things. Halt and Catch Fire, I've talked about it. You know, great, great show. I've talked about it on the podcast. We've had Christopher on to talk about it before. We've had Christopher on to talk about his She Could Fly series he did at Dark Horse. And so, Christopher's going to be involved in the Paper Girls. He's co-showrunner for the Paper Girls Amazon show. So he's really busy. So with his comics work, I got to imagine it's going to be a case where he's going to be so in demand and not have enough time because of the TV stuff and just not even have time to do all the comic stuff he wants to do. So pay attention when he does do something because it's going to be great. It's going to be, you know, no holds barred, pulling out the stops. He's going to explore these characters. Christopher himself is such a cerebral guy and so interested in the things about us that make us who we are in terms of our flaws and the things that are, you know, for lack of a better term, the things that are quote unquote wrong with us. Those are the things that make us human, our imperfections. And I just love the way his mind works. I love the way he tells a story. It's fascinating to me. So yeah, Doom, I'm not the biggest Doom fan. I'd go so far as to say I don't like Dr. Doom. He's pretty far down on the list of interesting characters to me. And I love this book. Like it's fantastic. It goes right up to the top of my stack whenever it comes out every month. So really, really great job by Christopher Cantwell and the whole creative team there. All right. Last Marvel book I'm going to talk about is Spider-Woman number 4. It's written by Carla Pacheco. Art is by Pierre Perez. Colors are by Frank D'Armata. And letters are by Travis Lanham. So the next issue, issue 5, is actually Legacy issue 100 of Spider-Woman. And I mention that because I do feel like this issue is fast-paced to the point of being too much. It's too fast-paced. It feels a little choppy. It doesn't feel like it flows quite enough. And I think it's because they wanted to get to a certain point to kind of tell a certain part of the story or get to the end of the story, kind of wrap up this first arc of Spider-Woman in that issue 100. So I totally get that, wanting that issue to be impactful. But I kind of feel like maybe if they knew that was going to be the case, and again, I don't know how much the pandemic or any of that played into this, because I feel like the first issue of the series was kind of, it didn't give enough story. So I feel like they should have put a little more in that first issue, but maybe the story didn't break down, you know, where it could have been done. It would have felt like an not a good place to stop. So again, and I'm not a professional comic writer. I'll defer to Carla Pacheco on that. I have been enjoying Spider-Woman. I enjoyed this issue. It just felt like there was a lot crammed in here and it got a little choppy. So I can't really talk about anything that happens without spoiling. So I'll just say that, you know, not only is it jam-packed in terms of how fast the story goes and how fast-paced it is, it's also jam-packed in terms of action. It's basically fights and action the entire issue. Like, and that also makes it feel like it's moving really fast. And that's part of it, right? Like so much action and so many fights that there's no room for the story to breathe or to kind of feel like you're pushing the narrative along because it's all done in the midst of this fighting through some exposition and you know, dialogue between the characters. So I'm very interested to see what happens next. I definitely feel like Carla Pacheco, and I think I've said this before, she gives the most authentic voice to Jessica Drew of anybody that I've ever read that's written the character. She feels a little younger than you necessarily would think based on how long the character's been around. She feels more modern, more relevant, as opposed to other people I've read that have written Spider-Woman, where she feels like this kind of old matronly type of hero who's kind of been around the block, been there, done that. And that's not as interesting to me. So I feel like she feels more contemporary and she's more realistic and she's more relatable. And I do like that. I wish she could have had maybe 5 or 6 more pages to kind of make it flow a little better, if you will. As far as the art goes by Pierre Perez, he's another artist I'm a big fan of. And there's no surprises here. The art's really spectacular. He does a great job. He gets to draw dinosaurs. He gets to draw laser beams. He gets to draw bullets. And all that is done really well. The color work by Frank D'Armata, the letters by Travis Lanham. Everybody's hitting on all cylinders here. And it makes for a really enjoyable story. But like I said, just that nitpick of so much story jam-packed into 20 pages here. Another 10 pages or so would have been nice. Could have gotten a little more interaction between the characters and a little more character development. So hopefully next issue, I mean, it is like Legacy issue 100, as I said, so it'll probably be double sized. I don't remember it just says next Spider-Woman Legacy issue 100. So hopefully that's an oversized issue and we'll get a little more interaction between the characters and it'll be a little slower paced. But if you've never read Spider-Woman, this is a series that you can jump on and really get an idea of who Spider-Woman is, especially because Pacheco is doing things here. She's mining things from Spider-Woman's past that are introducing new elements to it, but they make sense. And I've talked a lot in the past about when people go back and retcon things and they don't make any sense. It kind of bugs me. You know, think about like in Superman, where Brian Michael Bendis says, oh, this invisible mafia has been working in Metropolis for years and years and years. Superman never found out. Like, wait, what? That doesn't make any sense. Or same thing in Batman with the Court of Owls. Oh, it's been there ever since Gotham's founding. And Batman, the world's greatest detective, never knew, right? Because again, they're coming up with these ideas and they want them to be deeply rooted way back in the past and even from before the character made his debut. And I get that. But it doesn't make sense because you're going back and you're changing things and putting things in that happened in the past that don't really make sense with what actually happened in the past in the comics. What Pacheco's doing here, everything she's doing makes sense. It doesn't go back and contradict anything, or you don't find yourself saying, well, how could that have happened? Because she would have known or she would not have known, things like that. You know, like how could the Court of Owls have operated and Batman never know? There's no analogous problem. There's no plot hole in what Pacheco's doing. So I love that. What she's doing is additive and enriching the character and, you know, bringing her a larger supporting cast and making it where maybe we'll get a Spider-Woman title that lasts for longer than, you know, 5 or 6 issues. Because again, Pacheco, I think, great writer, underrated. Spider-Woman, good character, strong female character. I mean, it wasn't too long ago when we were looking at Marvel going, where's the female titles? Where's the, you know, titles that have female lead? And there, you know, were none of them. The line seemed real homogenous. And now there's more variety. I know some people claim that Marvel just is doing diversity for diversity's sake. That's not the case. You read this book is coming out and the story is being told because it's a good book and it's a good story. And Pacheco has an idea and a good idea, and it's a compelling story. And I'm finding myself really, really, really enjoying it. So definitely recommend picking up Spider-Woman if you haven't so far. All right. I feel like my voice is starting to give out here. I have a couple more issues to go. I'm going to go over these really quickly. I did want to mention this week's installment of the Dark Knight Death Metal series. There is no Dark Knight Death Metal issue this month, but there is the Speed Metal one-shot written by Joshua Williamson, art by Eddie Barrows, inks by Eber Ferreira, colors by Adriano Lucas, letters by Steve Wands. First of all, the art's absolutely spectacular. When you talk Eddie Barrows pencils, Eber Ferreira inks, and Adriano Lucas colors, that's the same art team that we had on the Freedom Fighters miniseries that Robert Venditti wrote. So the art's gorgeous. You know, I couldn't stop talking about how incredible the art was on that maxi series, and that team doesn't miss a beat here. So much like I was saying in when I was talking about Joshua Williamson's last issue of The Flash, and saying that he was putting the period on the end of the sentence, this is almost an underline at the end of the sentence to what I was saying about how Williamson is really tying a lot of the things up from some of the other things that didn't make sense from Rebirth, things that never got explained or didn't end up getting explored like they were supposed to, things from Snyder's Justice League run that didn't get fleshed out. And that's really what Death Metal is all about, right? Like, it's the anti-crisis. It's bringing everything back in, saying everything matters, everything counts. And this really does feel like an issue of The Flash. Obviously, it's set in the Death Metal storyline. And so we're looking at the DC Universe in this post-apocalyptic way where everything is a nightmare and there's, you know, dark versions of everybody. But we get Wally West, we get Wallace West, Kid Flash, we get Jay Garrick, we get Barry Allen, and the way they're interacting and the way they're using their powers and everything that happens in this issue feels very Flash. Like, you could not have picked a, you know, better person to write it than Joshua Williamson in terms of keeping that same tone that he's had in the Flash book throughout. Especially in terms of Wally going beyond Barry in terms of being a symbol of hope. Like, we always talk about Barry Allen being, you know, a glass half full kind of guy, being very much the hope and the heart and soul of the DCU. And we see Wally even, you know, fulfilling that role here or being right there with Barry, even to the point maybe he's surpassing Barry in terms of being that symbol of hope, that sort of emotional heartbeat of the DC Universe. And clearly, Wally's a beloved character. I mean, that's why the scene in DC Rebirth when he came back was so impactful for some people. I had some people in tears to see Wally come back. And so Williamson crafts a story here that is very emotional in kind of that same way. The visuals are impactful by the art team. And like, I would even say if you're a Wally West fan and you are not reading Death Metal and you don't have any plans to read Death Metal, just pick this up anyway and just read it on its own. Just read it on its own. You don't have to pick up Death Metal. You don't have to read the stuff that came before and you don't have to read the stuff that came after. You're going to, you know, we're all going to know what happens at the end of Death Metal just through either hearing it or reading it online or seeing the context as it's laid out in other books. But if you're a fan of Wally West, you need to read this issue. Again, beautiful art, gorgeous color work by Adriano Lucas. And just Barry Allen is my Flash, but issues like this, issues like DC Rebirth, really make me understand why so many people love Wally. And I love Wally too. It's weird for me because I collected Flash. I think I started collecting Flash with like issue 320 and it ended with 350 or 351. So I read it for a little over 2 years And then Crisis happened, and then I read Wally's Flash run up to like issue 170. So I actually probably read way more of Wally's being the Flash than I did Barry. But because Barry was the first Flash I read, that was always who Flash was for me. So I did always kind of understand, but like I said, issues like DC Rebirth and issues like this, really, they show why Wally is the Flash for so many people. And it kind of explains why, you know, people disliked Heroes in Crisis so much. But yeah, this is a fantastic issue. I wasn't even caught. I'm not 100% caught up on Death Metal. And I still read this and I was like, I'm not gonna not read this because, you know, it's Jay Garrick and Barry Allen and Wally West coming together as Flash. And I wanted to see, you know, what was going to happen. And then I opened it up and I saw the artwork and I'm like, yep, I'm just going to read this. And if, you know, I'm missing a couple issues in between, I'll pick it up. But I didn't need, like, there's nothing that happened in there that where I was lost at all. So again, if you haven't read any of Death Metal, I think you can still read this and enjoy it. The artwork, like I said, spectacular, color work spectacular, and really showcases why Wally is such a great character. All right, last book I'm going to talk about, Shazam number 15 from writer Jeff Loveness, art by Brandon Peterson, colors by Michael Ataya, and letters by Rob Lee. So I think I said when I talked about Shazam 14 a couple of weeks ago that it was the final issue. Turns out, no. There is an issue 15, which I had forgotten about. Once I saw the cover, I was like, oh yeah, I do remember them soliciting that. So 14 was the, you know, oversized last issue that Geoff Johns did. But I think this is the last issue. And it's kind of a standalone story by Jeff Loveness. Art by Brandon Peterson. The art is okay, but Peterson's style has really changed since what it was back in the 90s. I don't know if I like his newer art style. It's very smooth. It's very almost a digital painted looking artwork. And he does this thing where he outlines all his work, which is all his character work, which I think is just really weird. And most of the time they're outlined in like this white rather than like a dark color. You know, every once in a while they're outlined in black, but most of the time they're outlined in a bright color, a yellow or a blue or a white. And it's just weird. It looks like it makes them feel disconnected to the rest of the art. And I suppose that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to make them pop out of the page, but it doesn't necessarily work for me. As far as the story itself, it's a good story. I think Jeff Loveness has really shown me in the work he's done recently on Justice League and then in the Shazam story that I would like to see him get a long-term gig, you know, give him a run on something and see what he can do, because I feel like he does understand what it is that's at the heart of these characters. So it's a little topical. I could see, you know, people who are of the incorrect mindset that politics weren't in comics, don't belong in comics, because politics have always been in comics from the very beginning, starting all the way with Superman, Batman. But I could see somebody like that saying, no, I don't like this issue. Because it is kind of topical in terms of being there for your community, being there, being present for your family and for your classmates and for your colleagues and for your family. And, you know, I could see some people not liking that, but I feel like it very much suits sort of the feel and the tone of who Shazam is, who Billy Batson is in this current iteration. And so I did enjoy the story quite a bit. And the artwork in terms of the storytelling, Brandon Peterson's a great visual storyteller. I'm just not sure. There's just, you know, something about, it's almost, I want to say it looks kind of a little fake or plastic, like the way he does his artwork now. So I don't know. It's really strange. I've been reading a lot of his 90s work that he did at Top Cow, the Arcanum series, and it's so vastly different from this work. And so just kind of very striking to me. But all in all, it was a solid issue. Definitely glad that I read it. And just interesting that they threw that kind of one final issue out there. I mean, maybe Geoff Johns was originally going to do it. Maybe issue 14 was going to be divided into two and then decided to cram it all into one so he could just be done with it. And they already had 15 solicited. Not sure why it worked out that way, but I do feel like it was a worthwhile issue. So believe it or not, despite the fact I covered all those books, there are some other titles that you might be interested in that are coming out today. So let me run down a few of the other books that are on stands you might want to be on lookout for. If you missed Mega Man Fully Charged number one, there's a second print from Boom Studios out today. Also a couple of my favorite titles. One of my favorite titles of all time, Irredeemable from Mark Waid over at Boom. There's a softcover omnibus and there is a hardcover Incorruptible, which is a sort of a companion series to Irredeemable out today from Boom as well. Also want to mention from Boom, Unkindness of Ravens, number one, from Dan Panosian. And Dan's a friend. He's an incredible, incredible storyteller and artist. And I probably should have reached out and asked for an advanced copy of Unkindness of Ravens so I could have talked about it in a little more detail. But I'll probably cover it on an upcoming episode. And really excited for this. If you haven't read Slots by Dan, I definitely recommend that. And I do recommend Unkindness of Ravens. It's kind of a, I don't want to say Harry Potter because that's, that comparison's kind of been done to death, but it's, the premise is what if all the witches weren't burned at the Salem witch trials? What if some of them survived and got together? And now generations later, their descendants are, you know, still living in secret, if you will, hiding their abilities. So really curious to see what that's like. So definitely recommend picking that up. Also, another limited series from Boom, Wind, number four, from writer James Tynan, has issue 4 of 5 out today. Over at DC, in addition to the books I talked about, we have Action Comics, number 1025. We have Aquaman, number 63. If you're reading the Joker War, we've got a Joker War tie-in in Batgirl, number 49. We've also got Justice League Dark number 26 and Tom Taylor's Suicide Squad number 9 is a pretty important issue. Features some big events for some of the characters. So you may want to pick that up. Over at Image, Black Magic number 14 from Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott is on stands today. Gideon Falls number 25. Absolutely incredible series, Eisner Award-winning series from Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino. It's heading toward the end. 27 is the final issue. Issue 25 is on stands today. If you missed the first printing of Spawn number 309, which has the Gunslinger Spawn in it, there's a second printing coming out today. So you'll definitely want to pick that up if you missed that the first time around. I pretty much feel like I talked about every one of the Marvel books, but there are a couple that I didn't mention. Star Wars Bounty Hunters, number 5, with an awesome Lee Bermejo cover, is out on stands today. Tales of Suspense, number 39, facsimile edition. So that's the first appearance of Iron Man. So, you know, a lot of us are never going to be able to afford that. So you can get yourself a reprint facsimile copy for $3.99. That's out today. Venom, number 28, from Donnie Cates hit stands, and I think that is it. Well, let me mention from Valiant Rye number 7, written by Dan Abnett, hit stands today as well. And I should also mention from Vault Comics, there's a couple of really good series. Autumnal number 1 is out on stands. Engine Word number 3, which has been really well received, and then Shadow Service number 2 with an awesome Corn Howell and Triona Farrell cover is out today as well. So those are some of the other books you may want to be on the lookout for on your stands today. I want to thank everybody for listening as always. Hope I wasn't too spoilery. Don't think I was. Always strive to make sure to give you just enough to make you want to read the books and talk about a lot of them this week. So hopefully you find something when you get out to your local comic shop. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The readings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.